Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Guide Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour, and thanks for joining us. As we discussed last week, John is going to hook up with the guys from Shrek 3 this week, or Shrek the Third. John actually managed to go up and visit the DreamWorks facility and get a first-hand look at what goes into making what is one of the most successful animated feature franchises of all time. And John will be talking to Larry Cutler, who was the character TD supervisor at DreamWorks PDI. And he's been there since, I think, 2001, and was certainly the TD supervisor on Shrek 2. As well as talking to Matt Beer, who was the head of effects. And Matt actually worked on Madagascar. And so all of those films are huge hits in our family. We have two small kids and absolutely brilliant. And you might think that making a film like Shrek 3 was somehow, well, not maybe easy, but certainly, you know, you had the groundwork laid out for you. But you have to bear in mind that there's a bunch of interesting sort of pressures on a team that's doing a film like say, Shrek 3. And I guess first and foremost is the box office history of the ones that preceded this film. The initial Shrek film was about 2001, and it was about a $50 million budget and grossed about $500 million worldwide. They upped the budget 3 years later to about $70 million for Shrek 2, and that grossed worldwide nearly $1 billion, $915 million, I think it was. So the pressure going into Shrek the Third must have been enormous on the guys, and yet some of the technology to build the initial Shrek, as you'll hear in John's interview, some of the character technical stuff behind the scenes really needed to be updated to pull off some of the stuff they wanted. And the guys did a phenomenal job, and you'll hear not only discussions about those updating aspects, but also things like how to, well, I guess, art direct fluid dynamics, which is one of the problems that Matt had, and dealing with the huge number of additional characters in this film. There's now 70 significant speaking parts, and that certainly increased the workload on the guys. Quite interesting, apart from the film, is some of the history of DreamWorks Animation itself. DreamWorks Animation actually was, at one stage, PDI. And PDI was started, gosh, back in the early 80s, actually. And I remember running into Carl Rosendahl, who's one of the founders of PDI, at, I think it was a BDA conference in Los Angeles, and those were the days. They were really good conferences, those BDO conferences. But in that day, at that time, sorry, PDI did a lot of work. I mean, they did promo stuff for the various networks, and they did commercials and film clips, of course. They did the black and white morphing clip with Michael Jackson that really was phenomenally impactful at the time. And I remember talking to Carl and asking him why PDI had survived where so many other of the initial animation companies hadn't. I think at the time he said that the thing they put it down to most was putting power in the hands of the artist, that everybody else was going for Cray supercomputers and things, and they really went for some of the first workstations around. And by taking that approach and giving individuals the power and workstations and distributing the power to the artist, they went extremely well. And of course, around, about 2000, I think it was, they were acquired by DreamWorks, having done first Ants, which was a sort of a fairly modest hit. I guess it was a fairly big hit at the time. But then, of course, following Ants was Shrek 1, and Shrek 1 was huge. So, look, let's cross now to John, who's with Larry, and hear about the work in Shrek 3, and then after that, cross to Matt.
Well, thanks, Mike, for that, and Larry, thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations on getting the third Shrek out. Maybe finally you guys can get this right, and there'll be some people who actually show up to watch the film.
I know. We're hoping that will happen.
Well, obviously, I'm completely joking about that, because not only is work brilliant, but it's a hugely successful animated franchise. The reason I mention it, because it does have implications in what you're able to do workflow-wise and improve on things over time. But before we do that, let's get everyone up to speed about you and your department's role in the film pipeline.
Yeah, sure. Basically, I'm the character technical director supervisor for Shrek the Third, and our department is responsible for building all the characters that you see up on the screen. And specifically, we give the characters the ability to move and to act and emote in a believable way. So we do that by creating what we call character setups, which are really digital puppets for each of these characters. And they're very analogous to how you'd build a a puppet in real life, where we place an armature into our character setup. The armature represents the skeletal structure, sort of where the bones and the articulation points of the character are. It's very grounded in human anatomy and physiology. And then we provide lots of strings to the animators, or animation controls, and they control things from as simple as bending an elbow to things as complex as making a character smile or frown. And we spend a lot of time working with the animators to come up with the right set of controls. And then, of course, on top of that, once the armature is posed by the animator, we have to have the levels of deformation on top of that. So we have layers of muscle and fat, we have layers of skin, layers of clothing and hair, and all those react in a believable way as the character's moving. So the animator spends a lot of time manipulating the armature, and then all these different layers of skin and clothing react on top of that.
Now, are you using a lot of proprietary tools? I know PID Works, DreamWorks uses creates their own tools and stuff. Are you using any off the shelf? What kind of specific software are you using?
Most of the tools that we use are proprietary. It's a proprietary tool set. So basically, we have our own in-house animation system that we've been developing over the last 20 years, you know, primarily because when PDI opened its doors 20 years ago, there weren't off-the-shelf software packages like Maya.
Right.
So we had to create it from scratch. And therefore, you know, the character setups that we do are all written in our own proprietary language and our own proprietary tool set. So we use Maya a little bit for the modeling side of things. So we have a modeling department that creates the, you know, the 3D models of the character, just the sort of neutralized models of them that we start with. But apart from that, we really use all proprietary software.
Now, you're working on the third Shrek, and one might think that you've got, you know, a good number of the characters done, rigged and ready to go, because it is the third film. But actually, doing your third film gave you the opportunity to improve some things. So you actually ended up rebuilding some of the main characters for the first time, or for the second time, I guess, in this film.
No, that's true. It's a big misnomer. Everyone always is like, oh, well, you have all the characters, you know, from the first two films ready to go. It should be much easier to do a third film, right? And the reality is that we built Shrek and Fiona and Donkey, you know, the principal characters, we built them close to 10 years ago. We started working on them in 1998. And needless to say, the tools and the techniques that we use to do character setup have changed dramatically over the last decade. And as a result, we call these characters legacy characters, because they're a lot like a legacy piece of software, where it's very difficult to maintain them, let alone to add in new features. And so when we started taking a look at the story for Shrek the Third and a lot of the early storyboards, there were a number of things that were very troubling to us, such as Shrek and Fiona needing to be in these very elaborate royal costumes at the beginning of the film. And these costumes were multiple layers, and they had to come off on screen. And that was the type of thing that the old character setups really couldn't handle that.
Right.
And so it gave us the opportunity and the justification to go in, and we rebuilt these characters from scratch. So we basically built a brand new character for Shrek and a brand new character for Fiona and Donkey. And what was great about that is that even though they have to still look like Shrek and Fiona, under the hood, we were able to give them a new engine, you know, sort of soup everything up, give them a nice new dashboard, new fancy controls. And that really hopefully will allow the animators to have a much more subtle performance, and, you know, to be able to really see a more nuanced performance. So we were very happy with the result, but it's actually difficult work to rebuild a character and make sure that it still has the same look and feel as the original character.
Yeah, because it's still, while the look has evolved, it's still got to tie very closely. What were some of the things that you were able to do? What specifically for the animators were you able to do that they might not have been able to do with your previous character rigging?
Well, one of the biggest things is we were able to give animators a much broader range of motion to work with. So for example, Shrek was never able to sort of pucker his face very nicely, and so he couldn't, like, kiss Fiona very easily. And just little things like that, we were able to add in a lot of small anatomical details to the face and to the body. We were really able to do a better job of how the shoulders move, and we were able to do a better job of draping clothing onto the characters. And so all of these extra details, as well as the animators having a much broader range of motion to play with, you know, really, really add a lot. And it's something that you'll end up feeling, but at the same time, it's not something that can be that noticeable. And similarly, that's just on the character setup side. But then on the surfacing side of things, You know, there's been a lot of improvements in terms of the way that we handle skin and the way that light reacts with the skin, and just the, you know, just the artistry of the surfacers who work on these characters. And so Shrek's face just has this richness, and his skin has this richness that I think was probably missing in the first two films.
Yeah, it's got to be great, though, to be able to revisit some of the stuff and maybe do stuff that you wanted to do, but weren't able to do.
Yeah, because you start out with this incredible laundry list of, like, here are all the things that we know are wrong with these characters. And it's really nice to be able to come back in and really fix a lot of the things that we knew were problems. And, you know, of course, when you have animators banging away with the with these character setups for one or two films, you really have a good sense of what's working and what's not working.
Yeah. Nothing better than a little on-the-job learning. Now, it wasn't just the main characters that were rebuilt. There are actually a considerable increase in the number of secondary characters in this film, right? I mean, Princess Fiona has a court with other princesses. There's some improvements in the crowds and so forth. So you actually came up with an interesting way of dealing with having a large number of secondary characters, but kind of minimizing the right amount of work you had to do.
Yeah, so one of the unique challenges in any of the Shrek films is just the number of the character volume is just very, you know, very high. So we have a ton of secondary characters, and especially as we get to the third film, all the old characters need to come back as well. So we just have a very large number of secondary characters and actually a number of scenes that have crowd characters. And if we actually built unique character setups for each of these secondary and background characters, we would never finish working on the film. So what we do, and we've actually been doing this for each of the films, is that we create a small number of what we call generic characters. And so in the case of Shrek the Third, we created two men, you know, two males and right, one female. And so we have a thinner guy and a heavier guy. And then we have one generic woman character. We started out with two, but it turns out that our art director didn't really want too many heavyset women. So in the world of computer animation in Far, Far Away, I guess there are only thinner women. So we ended up with one woman and two guys. And then what we do to those character setups, we set them up the same way as we would any hero character, but we add in lots of levels of variation. So we create the ability to have a bunch of different physiques or bodies, a bunch of different faces, lots of hairstyles, lots of clothing, lots of, you know, accessories such as hats, purses, backpacks, you name it. And so with all these levels of variation, we're really able to provide a nice, you know, a nice set of background characters. And on Shrek the Third, we push this a lot in terms of using our generic woman and man characters for secondary characters. So you mentioned this a little bit that Fiona actually has this set of princesses that she hangs out with. And so there's Sleeping Beauty, Rapunzel, Cinderella, and Snow White. And these four characters are really just our generic woman characters. So there's sort of four different variations on our woman character, yet they're in 30% of the film. So we've never been able to do that before. So that was one of the nice benefits, is instead of having four unique setups, we were able to just get that all from our generic woman character.
It's actually got to be pretty nice for the animators as well to effectively only have to learn one or three rigs, I guess would be.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's one of the nice benefits, is that being able to copy animation, you know, when it's all one character, it transfers very, very nicely. And of course, you know, our system is set up, especially in a world like Shrek, where there are lots of human characters, that you can copy animation from character to character very easily. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't look quite as good when you're going from a different character
right
to, you know, one character to a different character. Whereas in this case, since they're all the same woman setup, it transfers very nicely and it's very easy for animators to work with.
And then from a viewing standpoint, of course, you really don't notice that either, though, just watching the film, of course.
Yeah, that's the goal. And it was funny, when we started out, that was one of the big question marks, is we were very much, you know, our department was very much saying, hey, we can get all this from just varying the bodies and faces and clothing and hair. And all of the, you know, the directors and the art directors were very trusting of us, because we've worked with the same crew and the same leadership for the last three films. So they were able to trust us that, yes, we could get, you know, these very different looks for the four princesses and nail that look. And I think in the end we were pretty successful, where you wouldn't say, oh, those actually are the same character.
And yeah, they weren't going right to you as you were explaining.
Yeah, early on it was a harder sell. So, you know, the problem is that it takes a while to get to the point where you can prove that it'll work. So we had to have some fallback plans, but basically we were able to successfully show that, yeah, this is a good way to go. And we started pushing that even more later on, where there's very few female characters that are unique character setups in our film. There's really just Fiona and Woman A. And, you know, between those two setups, we pretty much populate the entire world.
Yeah, it comes off really well. And I think one place I noticed it as well, and I think there's a significant leap in the quality of the crowds in this film, I thought. That probably had a role in it as well.
Yeah, I think we really put a lot of effort on our crowds in general on this film. You know, one of the things we've always had problems with is that crowds traditionally kind of fell through the cracks because it's so multi-departmental. You know, almost every department contributes to the look of the crowds. You know, character setup contributes. There's effects contributes in terms of animating the crowds. Animation contributes in terms of providing the cycles. And then lighting contributes in terms of providing the final look and as well as surfacing. So it almost touches every department. And we really try to centralize crowds and have a, you know, very specific crowd lead and a crowds department and crowd animators that before had been distributed. And that also, you know, just helped out a lot in terms of making crowds a big focus on this film in terms of, you know, making sure that they went smoothly and ensure that they actually got the time and the budget that was necessary. And, you know, also, you know, from our standpoint, having these brand new generic characters that we built from scratch and we put in so much amount of variation, much more than we had on Trek 2. I think there's about twice as much level of variation on them that, you know, that really helped contribute as well.
Yeah, it sure did. And it really did pay off in the end result, I've got to say. One other question I'm curious about, and maybe has a little bit to do with technology and processing stuff. When you're rigging the characters, were there any kind of improvements in like cloth simulation dynamics that you had to be worrying about?
Yeah, simulation in general is something that, you know, there's been a lot of advances between Shrek 2 and Shrek 3. So in terms of clothing simulation, we were still using the same, we actually use Maya cloth to do our clothing simulations, and we're still using the same simulator, but we're actually tackling much more difficult outfits. And on Shrek the Third, there's a lot more layered clothing. Mm-hmm. So where you have multiple layers of simulation, there's more baggy clothing and upper body clothing. Cause typically in the Shrek world, we can't afford to simulate every outfit on every garment, on every character in the film. And so some of the tighter outfits, they're part of the character setup. So Right. They're actually rigged clothing. And then the looser outfits tend to be simulated. And so the ratio of simulated outfits and the sort of, you know, the ambition of what's going to get simulated was much higher on Trek the Third.
Yeah, you have a proportional curve to the CPU Right. Processing power and technology.
But also, apart from the clothing, one of the things that we put a lot of effort simulation-wise on was hair, where we realized that hair is such an important part of both the silhouette of background characters as well as foreground characters, and getting the hair motion is one of the big limitations in the level of hairstyles that we have, that we actually ended up building two different hair simulators from scratch. Our R&D department developed a hair simulator that was really tailored towards doing long hair and curly hair, as well as then we have a hair simulator that was very tailored towards doing character dynamics that were, you know, poseable by animators. And so that allowed us to have a much more varied set of hairstyles. So we have a lot longer hairstyles. We have some characters with beards and long braids. And then at the same time, we were able to get a much wider range of silhouettes, and we were able to put more different hairstyles in our crowd characters as well. So that was an area where, from a simulation standpoint, we actually really changed the way that, you know, the type of simulation that we do.
Yeah, that's actually quite interesting, because thinking about it, there's actually far more human characters in this film, at least more that play a more prominent role. So that's probably actually becomes quite critical.
There really are. You know, with the first Shrek film, it was really much more about Shrek and Fiona, and there are very few human characters, relatively speaking. And Shrek 2, that number went up slightly, and then Shrek the Third, it exploded. And I think there's something like 70, you know, sort of speaking parts where, you know, characters had reason, you know, significant lines, not just a throwaway line. And so each of those had to have a unique look. And before, we had always been limited by the sort of number of hairstyles. If you only have four or five unique hairstyles for a generic character, that really limits, you know, that the amount of repeatability that you can have, you know, with those characters. And so on our, each of our generic characters have about 15 different hairstyles that to choose from. And then we also have some hairstyles that are very specific to characters. So some of the princesses, like Rapunzel and Sleeping Beauty, had these very specific hairstyles that, to them. So Rapunzel has this very long braid that extends all the way to the floor, and Sleeping Beauty has the shoulder-length hair that's very straight.
It works out much better because they're obviously not all going to the same hairdresser. You need
that's the hope.
Again, I find that interesting because I really like the idea of technology enabling things in the craft that really help in the storytelling. Because mm-hmm. honestly, that's something that maybe probably wouldn't have been able to be done for the first Shrek film, or at least done as effectively with all the hair simulations and so forth.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true that in the past, technology is, or lack of technology maybe, is limited, you know, the types of the stories or the types of characters that we can have in our film. And so, you know, having a character, Rapunzel, who's known for her long hair, when you can't simulate long hair, poses a big problem.
Yes.
And so, you know, we were really able to tackle that. And it was interesting because, you know, She ended up with this braided long hair, which was actually really part of the design, not necessarily for any technical reason, but just doing a long braid was something that we really could not have done on the first film for a character that's in 30% of the film. And, you know, we were able to do that, and it ended up not being something that was hand-tweaked very much. And similarly, having a character that has hair that is shoulder length and actually, you know, sort of splits between the shoulders is a really difficult problem, and it's something that, you know, I think we took a really nice stab at this time that was something that we really couldn't have done with either of the first two films as well.
Yeah, it really is interesting to take a look at the first two Shrek films after seeing Shrek 3 and look at the kind of technological and creative progression that's occurred over the franchise period. And again, you guys have had consistent improvement from Shrek 1 to the second, and now again from the second to the third.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks, Larry, for taking the time out of your schedule to speak with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And now let's turn our attention over to the effects department and Matt Bearer, who's the head of effects. Matt, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thanks for mentioning us and getting us out there for the tour. We really enjoyed checking out the facility and actually seeing the workflow in person.
Great.
We talked with Larry a little bit about the production pipeline. Again, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people might be familiar with kind of the generic CGI pipeline, but why don't you give us a little bit about direction of your role and your department's role in the making of the film?
Okay. Well, I actually had two roles on Shrek the Third. I started off as an effects sequence lead. And so essentially that's someone that's keeping an eye on a particular sequence and where effects fit into the sequence. And then also doing effects development and shot work on top of that. And then halfway through the film, I moved into the head of effects role, and then I kind of became more of the artistic and technical supervisor of our department.
So in that role, what did you end up meeting a lot to go over scenes with the director, review process, overseeing things? Like day to day, what do you do?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a transition because, you know, as an animator, you're definitely in the trenches all day
right.
doing shots and, you know, really kind of keeping an eye on of really what's kind of in the immediate vicinity of where you're working. As head of effects, it's a lot about scheduling and looking 6 months down the road to make sure that, you know, things will be ready when our department moves into a new area of the film, bidding, you know, deciding, you know, who should do what tasks and how we should team people up. So it's kind of a little bit more of a high level view of production and especially specifically for our department. So my goal really, generally speaking, is to help things move efficiently through our department.
Right, and that's kind of a natural progression as an artist moves through the ranks, isn't it? I mean, it's getting from doing in the trenches, doing work on the box, and then moving into supervisor role and overseeing role. How did you like that? I mean, what was that like for you? It's got to be kind of different, right, on the film?
Well, yeah, and I love doing effects animation, and I definitely left with lots more to learn, which I guess is good, but I actually tried to do some shots while I was supervising, and I have to say that I was very inefficient at it because I'd only get about 5-10 minutes here and there and a day, and it didn't work out as well.
Yes,
but the transition went really well. I mean, it's interesting moving into, you know, I've worked with a lot of our team for a long time. A lot of us have been here a long time. So in many cases, you know, for the most part, it's really just giving the artists and the developers just the information they need, and they run with it. And then trying to focus my attention in the areas where we really need it.
So those areas are, what kind of things would you be responsible in your area be responsible in the film? I know that the fire is a big one. It's always been an heroic part of Shrek, I think, from an effects standpoint, back from the very first one. But what else are the kind of things that you would add to the scenes?
Well, our department does a lot of things. In many, we have a regular, a really great R&D department here at DreamWorks. But also we have a lot of real technical people in our department. So we'll solve anything that is real production specific, in many cases, write tools that other departments might use, like tools for scattering or tools for generating trees. So we'll do, you know, some system level development on the production side, and then everything from there to writing shaders, supporting and writing our crowd pipeline and crowd simulation tool, to traditional effects like, you know, like dust and fire, smoke, all sorts of things.
So the fun
like
stuff.
So, yeah. And then there's a lot of subtle things too, like, just, you know, bringing environments to life, like making foliage move and grass blow in the breeze, and, you know, making fur blow in the wind, that sort of thing too. So there's kind of a wide range, which is good because it allows us to do a lot of different things. And even though it was a sequel, there's always something new. You kind of rotate people through different tasks on each show so they could kind of expand their knowledge.
Yeah, it's got to be interesting for you as well, moving from the first Shrek where you're an effects animator on, through this stage and looking at the way the technology changes and influences the art. I mean, what are some of the biggest changes actually from this film contrasted back to the first and things you guys have been able to do?
Well, on the effects side, we were able to do more complex simulations. We're able to render a lot more particles in the same amount of time. So pretty much we all have the same tolerance for render times.
Right.
Both films. So on the first film, we had to be a lot more picky and maybe not be able to use as large of a simulation or as complex of a simulation. So in respect of fire on Shrek 3, we're able to use fluid dynamics. And actually, speaking of fluid dynamics, I mean, just that in general has become so much more accessible to the artist.
Right.
That we're on Shrek 1, it would have been way too slow for us to deal with a lot of different shots using that type of system. But two, it's also the interface, and a lot of the third-party packages support fluid dynamics now with nice interfaces. So that on top of faster machines really allowed us to iterate efficiently and actually get fire in all sorts of places throughout the film.
Right, much more so than you were able to do in the past, right, on all those levels. Now, so you mentioned tools. And I know you guys have a lot of proprietary in-house stuff, but what are some of the actually specific tools that you're using to do your work?
Actually, a lot of it is proprietary tools. Like, we have our own particle renderer, which is fantastic. We have our own geometry renderer, our own compositor. Pretty much everything is proprietary, except in effects, we will use Maya for base particle simulations. We used it for the Maya fluid simulations for gases. We use Maya for gas simulations. Mm-hmm. For fluid simulations, we use our own proprietary fluid solver.
The benefits for working for a large company and having that type of R&D that you mentioned.
It is true. I mean, it's very true. I mean, it's in a way we're a little bit spoiled.
I was just thinking,
because I feel like if I only had a certain package, at some point you have to really work around a lot of things. You could hit the wall, and in many cases, we use Maya for what it's good for. It has a nice interface, and we can iterate quickly and prototype things quickly. But at the end of the day, we're exporting out as little as possible into our pipeline and then beefing things up with our own tools. So kind of in the back of your head, you always say, well, you know, I'm going to start in here, but I know that if I get into trouble or if I hit the wall here, I'm predicting I'll hit the wall in this area, I'll design my system in a way that makes the most out of Maya, and then knowing I could do more with the data before I go to the render.
Right, right. Well, let's talk specifically, since I mentioned fire, let's talk specifically about that and maybe walk people through how you actually execute that from like, what's your starting point? I mean, what are you given file wise, you know, setup wise, whatever, you're just working with geometry? Because there's a obviously a big, not climactic scene, but a huge fire scene in this film.
Yeah, we did have a lot of fire. Actually, a lot of the fire scenes actually came from comedy passes. Like they'll do comedy passes on the story. And it was funny, a lot of little explosions came from the Dronkies or just fire, wheels on fire, just, you know, funny gags. So what that usually means is the speed and the timing of the fire shots really isn't realistic. But at the same time, we want things to look physical, but also hit those story moments. So we did quite a bit of work. There's a couple guys in our group that really kind of proved that we would use Maya fluids for the fire early on that boat sinking shot. And so they did a lot of work trying to figure out how do you actually art direct this fluid dynamics. And then a bunch of us started jumping on, myself included, after they made finished that one shot. And all just really started collaborating, trying to figure out how can we really get the most out of this fluid solver, but also art direct it in a way that, you know, would allow us to get good iterations and be able to expand and increase the size of the grid, but not let the grid get too big. So we did write some tools that allowed us to dynamically change the resolution of the grid and the size of the grid on a per frame basis, so you could kind of keep it tight right around where the action is. So in a general, like for a torch shot, we would typically bring our proprietary format into Maya, you know, build some emitters. We kind of came up with some grid settings for the fluid solver that kind of worked across the board.
Right.
And we'd end up tweaking from there, but it took us a while. We finally found the 5-6 knobs that worked the best for us. And we'd take that through a few iterations just within Maya doing play blasts, and then we'd export that grid data back out. And one of our developers wrote a really great particle shader that allowed us to sample the grid and allowed us to render the fluids right inside our particle render. And so one nice thing about getting things back into particles is we've written a lot of tools over the years that allow us to massage particles or enhance them or clustering types of things. And we're able to use some of those techniques to actually tweak the fire after it was exported out of Maya. On top of that, one thing we always wanted to do was give lighters a way to illuminate their scenes using the real fire data. Mm-hmm. We'd always experimented with different techniques, and some of them the lighting department was never that thrilled about because it created artifacts or, you know, different types of problems, or it was slow. And in this case, we actually created geometry that was generated during the particle render stage and put through our blob tool, and baked all the colors of the fire into that polygonal file. Brought that into our lighting tool and used it as a bounce layer, which gave the lighters something that they're very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed us to, you know, kind of procedurally just output that, and then they would have their own little layer that allowed them to do interactive lighting, and that really helped tie our stuff in.
Wow, that's really interesting, working collaboratively with those guys like that and providing just an additional tool to help them. It's pretty cool.
It was definitely a lot of collaboration. I mean, there's 4 or 5 of us that were, you know, talking to each other all the time, like, oh, I just figured this out, and oh, cool, I'll try that, and really trying to, as we're all getting up to speed. And once we kind of got over that initial hurdle, then it was kind of, we kind of had our tools and our pack, you know, kind of our techniques kind of down, like how we'd emit into the grid. And from that point on, things went pretty smoothly.
Right. So coming out of your department, it's the file format they're working on is actually like a scene description thing with geometry, certain renders or particle simulations baked into that, and then it goes to final rendering, or how does that work?
Yeah, it kind of depends on whether you're going to do a particle render or a geometry render. We have our own, they're separate right now, but we have ways of accessing data from one or the other. So for just straight particle rendering, we have our own proprietary format that stores particle positions and all the other great data that you might want to use as a renderer or for your clustering steps. For the geometry, we have, you know, we have our own NURBS and polygonal representative formats that we could read into our renderer as well.
For the rendering, what kind of horsepower do you guys have? Are you familiar with the kind of setup? I mean, CPUs have changed over the years and so forth, but
I don't have a lot of specifics on that. All I know is that things have gotten so much faster.
You're just able to do things, yes.
We are, and truthfully, we, you know, they've set it up in a way that our effects department, you know, we have a way to submit really fast renders and get really quick turnaround. While lighting, you know, they have a little bit longer turnaround, so we're able to kind of squeeze our stuff in this little kind of quick part of the render farm, which is great. Because a lot of our product renders are actually very fast, as well as our comps, and that's typically what we're iterating on is these product renders and comps. So the turnaround time has been great. It's fantastic, actually.
So it's actually interesting, and you mentioned the use of the effects in a comedic way. I don't mean to imply that effects and VFX are driving the story. But it's quite interesting that now, because of the changes in technology and software, you're actually able to really help in that creative storytelling process. I asked Chris Miller about that, and he kind of agreed. It wasn't driving it, but it did really help tell the story.
Yeah, it's truthfully, as an effects animator, a lot of times you feel like you're really just kind of bringing environments to life and really just trying to make things integrate into the scene. There's satisfaction in that, but it is so nice to be able to say, oh my gosh, people are actually going to see this. And, you know, I have to really come up with some creative ways of hitting these, you know, non-physical timings. So it's, truthfully, it's great. And on Shrek the Third, there's just a ton of these types of effects, which was great for all of us. It gives them a little bit more exposure, which means the approval process is a little bit different. You know, mm-hmm. You put it in front of a lot of people, but it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, that's it. And there's other stuff, too. And another big part of what you did in Shrek 3 is actually some of the magic effects, which I've got to say are probably conceptually pretty difficult. You kind of a broad range, right? And what is a magic effect?
Yeah, so the magic effects, we have, you know, these different magic effects in all the Shrek films. And they're always very abstract. They're very hard to define. And a lot of times they're really, you're only given verbal direction from either the director or the VFX soup or the production designer. Occasionally they'll paint something in the art department, but a lot of times that you don't want to get too pigeonholed by that, because a lot of times it's the way things move and not just the static frame that would be painted by the art department. So it does take a specific type of animator that one can just come up with a ton of different ideas and be able to interpret that verbal direction and be able to kind of prototype, like, almost the first third to a half of the time we spend on these magic shots is really trying to narrow down the artistic direction.
Yes.
Because everybody has kind of a different idea. I'd have a different idea. You know, our VFX suit Philippe would have a slightly different idea. And we're talking all the time, trying to narrow down what's inside everybody's brain.
You're not going out to shoot reference for magic.
Well, we try to shoot reference for lots of things because it's inspiring. So like for the magic, it's even more, you know, like when you look at reference for like fire, you're kind of like, that looks great. That's kind of what we want. That's the right color temperature we want. For magic, we were kind of like looking at a thing. Maybe we want a smoky magic effect. We would actually just say, well, that little part, we want that to be kind of the render treatment. But there was really not a great way to describe the motion. So we ended up describing the motion in just really funny ways. Like, you know how a washing machine churns the fluid and so, like, the names of these elements just got these really goofy names. And in the end, we're like, we really need to rename these elements because they sound so goofy. But it was kind of the way that we would describe the motion. You know, that has to have the washing machine, or that has to have the, that should be like a noodle or something like that.
Right.
But just the way you describe it is you kind of have to do whatever you can do to kind of get everybody on the same page.
It kind of explains a lot of the first, as you said, front third of the time spending figuring it out, because these are very obscure concepts.
Right, yeah, so there's a lot of ideas. Just these guys are cranking ideas out, the animators that worked on the magic, because there's several different types of magic. And part of the desire is to make something new, so the audience sees a new type of magic. So that's another constraint as well. I think, you know, you don't want it to look like any other magic from any other movie. You don't want it to look like any other magic from the other Shrek movies, but it still has to fit into the Shrek world. So there's kind of these loose guidelines as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's got to be another one of those areas where the technology and the speed of rendering stuff has helped you as well, and experimenting, I would think.
It's fun. It's fun, but you have to really have a lot of endurance to work on one of those effects.
Yes, I bet.
Can't get your feelings hurt. You're going to end up throwing away a lot of really great ideas.
And the last thing I just want to talk about is we touched on it a little bit earlier is some of the secondary characters and things that were done to kind of take the characters to a higher level than what you were able to do in the previous Shrek films. And one of those was the hair development process was also done.
That's right. So a lot of our pre-production time was spent on hair. And so that actually crosses all departments here that worked on the film. So, I mean, that starts with character TDs to modeling, effects, lighting, like everybody and surfacing, the texture painters are all joined together on this kind of big goal, which was to make hair better, to have more hairstyles, to allow hair to move more physically correct. You know, because we did some complex hair shots on Shrek 2, but it was using tools that really weren't designed for what we were using them for.
Yep.
So part of the development was we had, you know, an R&D person working on a hair simulator sitting down in the effects department. So we had him paired with one of our effects developers, and they were working on this strand solver together. And then we had other people working with modeling and texturing to come up with different ways to style hair. And we're still always looking for better ways to do it, but on Shrek the Third, you know, we came up with a way for modeling to kind of create approximate geometry to kind of get the volume of the hair, and then we wrote tools that would generate guide curves off of that.
And this was important because I guess Princess Fiona's court, in essence, or there were a lot in addition to secondary characters, but the court actually has, it's women, and it's their hair is not just all tied up behind
That's
them
right.
or something like that, right? These are, you know, very visible characters in the film, so you really needed to take that the hair to the next level.
Yeah, not everybody could have a crew cut,
right?
All the princesses had very different styles and actually used a different simulation techniques as well. Like Rapunzel was done in the character TD department, and then the Sleeping Beauty, which is long straight hair, she that was done using the strand solver, and that was kind of a co-development across, you know, from R&D to effects, and then the shot work was done in our character effects department. But what it allowed us to do was, you know, on the first Shrek, we spent a lot of time on the main characters, and what's nice moving on to a sequel is you've kind of figured them out, maybe improve Shrek and Fiona a little bit, but now you have time to spend time on these background characters. And you're not limiting the directors to saying, well, they don't really hold up that well up close. But the goal on Shrek 3 was to be able to bring them into the scenes and not limit the story by saying, you know, well, technically these background characters don't work. So there's a lot of effort, both from the texture painting standpoint to you know, effects and lighting development, to get them to hold up as well as the primary characters.
Well, again, that's really great because I think you're fortunate to be able to have worked in a franchise, a hugely successful franchise, I might add, like Shrek, because you are able to learn from each film and improve things in the film going down the road. And that's got to, again, be a blast for you, having been involved in some way in all three of them.
Yeah, it's been really fun.
Well, I appreciate your time. And again, that's in the theaters now. And it's got to be good to have that wrapped, though, at this point, at the same time.
Yeah, we're happy. We're on to something else now. So we're still busy. It's there's a lot of work here.
Well, thanks again. Well, again, thanks for letting us talk to you. And again, thanks for getting us involved and having us come in to visit. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for coming up, John.
Thanks for that, John. And that's it for another week. We're going into the summer blockbuster period. And of course, we're going to be covering that. And we've got some amazing interviews lined up with some really big facilities over some of those large films. But I also wanted to flag to you guys that we're going to be covering some episodic television and commercials work. Thought it's kind of a pointless thing to just cover the big feature films when there's so much other great work being done. So I'm really proud to say that in coming weeks we'll also have interviews with the visual effects team from the show Heroes, huge favourite of mine, as well as some amazing work that's been done by some guys on some Sony TVC commercials, some brand new ones that have only just come out. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy those as much as I am. They're really getting behind the scenes and looking at some of the detailed work that's being done. And we just want to make sure we don't just focus on one part of the industry, given there's so much good work being done in so many areas. Hey, we're always keen to get your feedback, and we got some great feedback this week from quite a few people. So please take the time to let us know what you think, and we want to be as involving as possible. So if you can sort of send us ideas of things you'd like, we'll try and incorporate them. But on behalf of Jeff, John, and myself, I just want to say thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys online at fxguide.com. And until next week, I'm Mike Seymour.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.